Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for joining us at Nikki Dare Radio on Blog Talk Radio, heard worldwide by millions of listeners, with your lovely host, Ms. Nikki Dare. Our podcast, hosted by Nikki Dare, is your home for education to safety and survival, leadership and inspiration. Nikki Dare is the founder of iDare Inc., a registered 501c3, with its mission to educate and mobilize resources for preparedness and sustainability. iDare is a grassroots credo and personal mission based on its pillars of excellence: integrity, diversity, adaptation, resilience, and empowerment. Ms. Dare's personal mission is to help you encounter your purpose by unlocking your inherent potential and finding joy in the journey. Nikki Dare is the published author of The Audacity of Veracity, a columnist, Women in the Field of Western Outdoor News, California's publication of Fishing and Hunting. Ms. Dare is a certified firearms instructor in rifle, shotgun, and handgun, RSO, range safety officer, and CERT, Community Emergency Response Training Member, a FEMA certified training, women's advocate, transformational mentor, and a seasoned BPR change management consultant since her early 20s in transforming companies. And decades later, she is reinventing her purpose. Nikki Dare's life has been spent passionately in helping others going through transformation, both personal and professional. And now, here's your lovely host, Ms. Nikki Dare.
All right, good morning, guys. Glad you can join me again. I am Nikki Dare, your host. Disaster does not recognize who or what you are. Disaster does not recognize your social status, financial status, gender, ethnicity, or age. Disaster comes in many different types as we know it. They come in different forms, weather related or man-made or even terrorism. Unfortunately, we do live in this ever-increasing violent world, as we know, and then we must face this in so many different ways. Unfortunately, trend continues, guys. There are disasters and emergencies that can be avoided, which, if we can take precautions, we can certainly reduce the risk of the impacts. However, there are those that we cannot, as to say, unexpected Mother Nature wrath. And that's what we've been talking about all of this time in many different sessions in my podcast. But this particular episode, I'd like to focus on discussing in the tragedies and the tragic, unfortunate tragic that we had just had recently. We talk about Manchester attack, and then recently we just had this London attack. So with me here this morning, I would like to continue this discussion with my returning guest, as you already know, David Gray, and also a returning guest way in the past, and I managed to bring him back here, Mr. Patrick Garrity. And you will get to know him a little bit better again, those of you who don't know him. So I'd like to just go ahead and let you know that Patrick Garrity, I'm so sorry, Patrick Garrity, a former Marine also, with a very impeccable background combined with his military and non-military. He also is a Hollywood stuntman, whom many of us know from the famous movie, The Shooter. He was a technical advisor to Mark Wahlberg in that movie, as well as another movie. I think recently he did The Sniper with Tom Berenger, another movie back in 2014. Is that correct, Patrick Garrity, the year?
Yes. Okay. It was Sniper Legacy.
Sniper Legacy, to be exact. That was the title of the movie. So with all that fun in Hollywood scene, you can find Garrity also on the range. He teaches firearms from basic to advanced tactical training to self-defense with a school called Defensive Firearms Training. He also just completed his bachelor degree in POLSI, Political Science in International Relations. And a couple of years ago, he completed his master's in National Security Studies with focus in cybersecurity. And currently, Garrity resides in Santa Barbara, California. And also, Mr. David Gray, this morning we have him back in our podcast here that we want to discuss with him as well. I guess it's in the middle of the night or in the morning right now on the other side of the globe. Mr. David Gray, he is a young man also who has such impressive portfolio from being a veteran from Marine Corps as well. Stuntman in Hollywood also with TV shows among the ones that he has done in the past. Shows called CSI Vegas. I think I recall seeing those on TV. Great shows, by the way. And many others. He also is a published author to currently owning his own international security company named Deimos Security. Based out of Bangkok in Thailand, Mr. David Gray. Hello, good morning. Or is it good morning, good night, good evening?
Good morning. It's almost 11 in the morning.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. I know that it's kind of like a little bit challenging for you to keep up with us here. And also, good morning, Patrick Garrity. How are things with you?
Good morning.
All right,
it's
great.
Actually, good evening over here.
Right, he's out in Santa Barbara, you ladies. So, anyway, this is just an important topic, y'all. We just want to continue this topic because it is hit home, and I just want to have a shout out with the ladies also. These are the perfect gentlemen, by the way, to have on your side when the things, I can say this, you know, doo-doo hits the fan. Train with them. So I know it's a little bit difficult to train with Mr. David Gray. He's out in Bangkok, but, you know, connect with him. He's got a lot of valuable information when it comes to training with all kinds of sort of, a lot of them, firearms, non-firearms, also as well with Patrick Garrity. So, all right, it should be legit that I should say this. I feel safe arm with them right now. Welcome, gentlemen. Glad to have you back here. So what do you think what is going on right now around the world? I mean, you know, with all of these things going on, the criminals, I mean, we watch them. They're packing up more and more sophisticated way, I think, you know, in the wake of Manchester terror attack last time. We spent hours talking about this with Mr. David Gray on all episodes. And then it's continuing on with the last week's, you know, London attack. Share with us some of the life savings tips, you know. I mean, we all know it only takes a few seconds for life to be changed, right? Dramatically, forever. So what are the things that we, you know, civilians need to be aware? I mean, there's so many things that are just overwhelming at the moment, right? So I'm going to go with Patrick Garrity first, and then, you know, we can also share turns with David Gray after that. Go ahead.
So you bring up a very good topic, basically how there's two things here. How does one protect themselves against attacks like this or increase their odds of not being in these attacks or surviving these attacks? The other side of the coin is how does the government protect the people? Because we have that social contract that we give up some of our rights and pay taxes so that we vote in a government that is supposed to protect us from anarchy and chaos. That's political science 101.
Right.
You know, but the important part is what you brought up. How does one protect themselves from attacks like these? And, you know, the blunt answer is you can't, because, as you pointed out, that a life can change in seconds, you know. The one thing that people can do, and this goes back to last time you had me on the show, was situational awareness. It applies here as well. If you're situationally aware as an individual, meaning you're aware of what's going on around you, whether that be somebody trying to dart across the street in front of you while you're driving a car, or somebody dropping a backpack and walking away in front of you as you're walking to a store or something.
But is that enough, though? Is that enough to protect? Is situational awareness enough to protect, defend yourself in the event of this? I think, David Gray, you can also weigh in on this, because you did mention something like this last time. It's beyond that you mentioned, if I recall you, on the last Manchester attack you mentioned.
Yeah, situational awareness is always your first step. Then your second step would be to kind of evaluate what's going on. In your situational awareness, you have to be a little bit premeditated. If you walk into an event or an area, you kind of got to know where your best route in and out is, and where your safer places would be inside that environment. So you start with situational awareness, and then you start to pre-plan things as you walk in. Typically, when I walk into a crowded shopping market or even a street market, what I'm looking for is toilets, exits, and security or police within seconds of walking in. It's just something I look for immediately now.
That's from your experience, obviously, because that's what you do. That's what you do. You protect. I mean, that's what you do for a living. You protect, you diagnose and you assess all of the situational, exits and everything else. Now, going back to Patrick, go ahead and finish your thoughts on the situational awareness.
Well, that was it. There's multiple steps here. You obviously have situational awareness first. The plan of action comes next. You have to assess the situation because there's so many different things that happen, whether it's a bus bombing or somebody walking along the street like in the Boston Marathon that drops a backpack, planes flying into the building. There's many ways that this can be accomplished, that these attacks can be accomplished. And there's ways that we haven't even thought of that will be done in the future. So the thing is you want to think in generalities. Just like David was saying, you're always looking for exits, you're always looking for an out. Very similar to when you're driving on the freeway, you kind of give yourself some space between cars in case you have to shift right real quick and change lanes because the car in front of you hit the brakes real quick. You always want to leave yourself an out, and you're kind of assessing that situation as you walk through it or as you're living through it. But to plan for specifics is impossible. You can
run the heck
out of every situation.
Right.
Those are the steps. To take it past the plan of action would be to, assess the situation further, continue to assess, continue to act.
Right.
And not be one that's just frozen in place.
Right, right.
There's obviously people that need to be helped. There's emergency services that need to be notified, things like that.
That's probably the
final step. Anyway.
Yeah, I want to go back to the really, really what happened in London, that tragic day. I want to just go ahead and then vividly, how it happened and everything. All right, it was happening June 3rd in London District. It was a van mounted the pavement of London Bridge, right? Went through pedestrians. The van crashed, and the three male occupants of that van ran to a nearby pub where they just went at it. They went stabbing people with long knives. Now, eight people were killed and 48 were injured, including the four police officers, and they were unarmed who tried to stop the assailants, obviously. And the three attackers, they were wearing fake explosive vests. But obviously, they were all shot dead by the police at the end. Now, you imagine that, when you are doing that. I mean, what do you think, David Gray? I mean, we talk about this at Manchester.
Here's the first reality that we need to face as a civilian population with a very large population around us is that it took 8 minutes from the first phone call for the police to arrive on scene and shoot those guys. So it took 8 minutes for someone
to
come
and
physically stop the attack.
Long time.
In 30 seconds, you can stab someone 30, 40, 50 times. They're being able to run around and just stab random people for 8 minutes it's an astronomically long time. It's going to seem like forever when you're stuck in that kind of situation. And the people who survived they survived because typically other people got involved and interceded on their behalf. There was a bouncer, a doorman, who initially started to run and leave with everyone else when they ran into the pub. He tried to run back, but then he thought to himself, well, there's people left behind, and they're just getting stabbed, and he's watching this woman get stabbed, and she got stabbed to death, and he turned around and ran back and started beating them up using whatever he could grab, chairs,
right.
bottles,
right.
Weapons of opportunity. So, for me as a person I am, I know I wouldn't be the first one to run away. I would make sure that my family and friends are getting away and they're going in a safe direction. I would assign them specific jobs to do. Hey, you call the police, you call so and so, or you head over that direction and stay there and wait for me. And then I would turn around. I would look for weapons of opportunity that I could use to defend myself and defend others against the attackers.
What do you think, Patrick?
I think that's absolutely what needs to happen. If you're with loved ones, they need to get to, you need to get them to safety first, and then if you're somebody like we are, you know, that's adept to situations like this and can respond to situations like this, that's the best bet, because as pointed out in the actual situation, the response time of law enforcement is not very effective in these situations initially. Mm. You know, the perpetrators were taken down by law enforcement, but after the damage had already been done, and that's usually the case. So what happens in that situation is you either have a bunch of people fleeing the situation, you may have a couple dedicated people in there, like veterans or off-duty police officers, that can do their best to try and control the situation. I want to point out that example of the train terrorist operation that was on, I think it was on its way from Paris, that was stopped by a couple of veterans,
right,
or
right,
active duty service members that recognized the sound of an AK-47 being charged.
Right.
And they assessed the situation, came up with a plan of action, and saved the day, saved the train from getting shot up, you know. So initially it's going to be people like that respond. But those are, as David mentioned, those are the proper steps. Get your loved ones to safety, you know, give them directions, like make a phone call the, you know, emergency services and whatnot. And then if you're one of those people that can act, do so. You know, and every situation's different. You want to try and locate, close with, you know.
Right.
Figure out what's going on, where all the bad guys are, find the safest way to them without drawing attention to yourself doing so, and then, if possible, you know, find a weapon of opportunity or take a weapon away and disarm and whatnot. It's not as easy as we make it sound, you know. In an adrenaline-infused situation.
Right. Like, it's human nature. We all get panicked. Right. Right. I mean,
yeah,
but
there's always going to be a few of those that are willing to run towards the situation when everybody else is running away or standing there frozen, not understanding what's going on. You have that happen a lot in these active shooter situations in schools.
Right.
You know, these kids hear pop, pop, pop and don't think it's a gun because they're not familiar with that sound.
Right.
They don't do anything for the first 30 seconds until they hear screams, and then they panic and run. You know, and that's why the response time is what it is because people don't believe what's happening in the situation, they don't realize what's happening in the situation, and they're not quick to respond. And then the adrenaline hits them, and they don't know what to do, and they don't know how to deal with the adrenaline. You know, but there's always going to be hopefully one or two of those people that have been in these types of situations that know how to respond. And that's really what buys time for the law enforcement, local law enforcement authorities to get there.
So you're talking about the train versus the non-train. And then we can sway discussing about, you know, well, because of your background also and your studies, Patrick, about the government, how, you know, it's not all the civilians' fault as well, to, like you said. I mean, it just picked on my brain a while ago about the children not familiarized with, you know, the sound. Or what is that sound? Because they don't know what it sounds like, right?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, David?
Yeah, that is the issue. I don't know how you train for that. But other than on an individual level, families, you know, just like you would a fire drill in your home, you know, you do a home defense drill. Just like fire drills.
In the schools in the 1950s in the U.S., we used to teach firearms.
Exactly.
Part of the fitness and education program for recreational activities.
It was taken away.
it was taken away, and it wasn't due to any kind of violent act in the school.
Nope.
It was due to you know, bureaucracy and legislation or whatever, financial cuts it could have even been. But
Department of Education, I think I believe it was.
All the people that grew up in the 50s, they were fairly knowledgeable about what firearms sounded like and how they operated and how they worked and what the safety conditions were. And we've moved away from that.
Right.
And now schools, they're not even doing the mandatory fire drills that they used to do. And since we started having active shooter attacks in school, they started re-implementing those fire drills, those emergency drills, and what to do in those kind of situations. And for me, as an instructor, one of the things that they should be doing, that I think they should be doing, is having a role-playing scenario,
right,
with students that are involved. They need to know how to react.
Right.
They need to know what's going on.
I just had an event, like a small workshop, community workshop down here locally. And then I was talking to some teachers, and then they were saying that, yeah, we just started implement the active shooter, scenario training with the students. And, of course, immediately I asked, like, who's instructing this? Believe it or not, the teachers themselves. And I'm like, really? I mean, how do you feel about that, Patrick? I mean, you know, I'm trying to sum up what David was just saying. Like, you know, you should implement the scenarios and then, you know, role-playing with the students and everything. But how do you feel as instructors, both of you? You know, I'm an instructor myself, and when I heard that, I have uneasy feeling about it, you know? I don't know. I mean, you tell me, you guys.
I think in large part the reason that the teachers are doing it is because the school districts don't have the budgets.
Right, yeah, I think,
hiring.
For sure, yeah. That's the you know, the response on that. But you know, how do you feel about that? I mean, you know, I don't think that's appropriate, is it? As an instructor, would you think? What do you think?
There definitely needs to be a professional involved.
Yeah.
I don't see how a local law enforcement should be charging a school to show up and do a demonstration. You know, that shouldn't cost anything. We pay for them to do things like that.
Well, that was my first response. Like, you know, is this law enforcement come to the class to instruct this? And then she said, no, it's the teachers. You know, obviously it's a budget issue kind of thing, right? So I get it. But I don't feel good about that. What do you think, David Gray?
After the Columbine shootings happened, and the police departments found out how unaware they were of what was going on in the schools and things like that, a couple of friends of mine, who you may know, Andrew Neal and Timothy Lynch, started going to schools and doing training with the police, active shooter kind of training with the police, and then involving the teachers, and then eventually involving the students,
right?
At least the senior level students, in what was going on in the training. And they, you know, they were doing it for free, and they ended up getting a little bit of financial benefit out of it eventually, just to cover their expenses. But then, you know, that kind of had to stop, because nobody can do something for free all over the country all year round.
Yeah, right.
I think that kind of thing would be beneficial.
Yeah.
I don't know that police departments can conduct it just by themselves, because you need many role players. You need
absolutely.
You need some different aspects that most police departments aren't even trained to do as far as instructing and teaching. So it would be beneficial if the teachers and the instructors all took an educational training course on active shooters.
I think
or,
so.
You know, especially for teachers, take some firearms training, get
right.
some understanding of how
right.
things work.
Exactly.
And then move on from there. It would be easier for them to build a curriculum that's more realistic for training the students if they've had some training themselves first. Teachers just going out and winging it without any kind of experience or background knowledge, it sounds like it could end up being more dangerous.
More dangerous than, right. Well, I'm thinking out loud right now as you're speaking, David Gray, because you mentioned last time when we talked about Manchester Massacre about, you know, it's a skill. You can use that skill. And then we also talk about the scenario where, hey, you see a gun during all of this, you know, incident, and then that's the gun, the weapon of opportunity that you can probably protect your students, let's say. Now you got the skill. Now what do? Before the bad guy will take over, right? You know what I'm trying to say?
Most of the active shooter or active knifing type situations, you have three typical steps that you can decide to do. You can flee, you can run, you can hide, mm-hmm. hide in place and barricade yourself in place, or you can fight. So those are your typical options. They come into play. And you can expand on each one of those extensively, but I think that people need to be trained to deal with those three types of situations. Okay, how do you hide effectively?
Right.
How do you know when it's time to flee, when it's time to run? Which direction do you need to go? What other considerations are there that you might want to put into play along the way? And how do you know when it's time to fight? And
right.
How do you fight? And
right.
What do you fight with?
Now, without proper background of knowledge, like Patrick was saying, you know, like, hey, situational awareness application, perhaps, you know? I mean, all of this, if you just give somebody something that they're, you know, with no other application beforehand, and then just kind of go to intermediate or advanced, and then here you go, it can get scary, and it can backfire and be dangerous, you know, injure themselves instead of you know, trying to protect them, themselves. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I do believe in training, you guys. I really do. I do believe in role-playing. I do believe in simulating things, not just a one-way discussion lecture, like you sit there and listen to me. No, I do believe in all that interaction, you know. Role-playing is important. Simulate this kind of things in different scenarios. Like Patrick was saying, it's impossible to avoid this kind of different things, you know, different scenarios. But yeah, I mean, you could certainly play it out, you know, but they're getting so sophisticated, these criminals, you know, so sophisticated. And then, go ahead, I'm sorry. I get carried away when it talks like that.
going back to the London stabbing, there were several things that, when I looked at the map and the diagram that showed their travel, their path of travel, they covered almost a kilometer in distance from the bridge to the pub to the market. And in that amount of time, they're stabbing people along the way. And then in the videos and photos of inside the pub, when they're first inside the pub, I'm looking at these videos and I'm thinking, wow, there's weapons of opportunity all over the place, not just glasses and chairs. There's a fire extinguisher that's present by the front door, a powdered CO2 fire extinguisher.
Right.
There's pool cues, and there's cutlery that's about as well. So if they come at you with something like a knife, you want to create some distance, you can use a fire extinguisher. You could use any type of insect spray.
Yeah.
It propels at a distance. It's blinding. And you can use pool cues, chairs, bar stools to create distance between you and them and pin them against the wall until they can either be disarmed or taken out of the fight by knocking them unconscious or just completely stopping them.
I mean, there's certainly a lot of people in the around that area, correct? I mean, if they can kind of like, you know, group together. But then again, you know, who do we to? That's. So what do you think, Patrick, as far as a weapon of opportunity and then creating distance and all of that? I mean, you're very experienced in that too as well, training.
All those are sound tactics. And that's the whole fight part of the run-hide fight, you know, which is not only applicable in schools with kids, but, I mean, that's pretty much the real life if you're a civilian and caught in the middle of an attack. Mm-hmm. If you're far enough away and can get behind cover, you run. If you're even further away and it's only within sound distance of you, then you can probably hide or also run and hide. You know, if you're right in the middle of things, then it might be time to fight. Last year I worked out, I think schools are adopting these training things more and more now that these attacks are becoming more common or they're more widely reported on. Last year I had the opportunity to work on a public service announcement short film that was going to be distributed to all incoming freshman students at a college up in Northern California.
Oh, good.
On how to deal with an active shooter situation, and that's exactly what it was. Run. You know, how are you hiding? How are you barricading yourself in? And fight. What are you using? There's weapons of opportunity around. If you're in the thick of it, you need to fight. You know, those are sound tactics, you know, and when David got into the specifics of it, you're absolutely right. Distance is your friend, you know, unless you have no weapon and you're right in the middle of a situation where your arm's distance away from an attacker caught by surprise, then, you know, if distance isn't your friend, then it might actually be a good idea to step closer if you're that close and to try and go for a disarm. But that's something I don't advise unless you know what the heck you're doing. It'll hurt. But if you're trying to save a crowd and...
I think we just lost Patrick. But yeah, I mean, going back to you, David, I mean, let me try to get him back again on the phone if I can. I know he was saying that to me. But yeah.
If you're within arm's reach of an attacker with a knife, one thing that you should expect is to get cut,
call back,
to get stabbed. You need to accept the fact that you're going to get an injury to an arm or a hand or possibly to your body, and you need to do your best to avoid getting injured into vital areas. So when you turn and attack your attacker, you need to accept the fact that you are going to get injured.
Right.
And you can do you need to try to do everything you can do to minimize those injuries being fatal.
Right. I think we mentioned that last time too. And all right. So all of this is just going back again, circling back to, hey, you know what? You need to get training. You need to get training is vital in everything. You know, training. We lost you, Patrick. You're back?
Sorry, I'm back.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Yeah. So go ahead and finish it up.
If I can just finish what I was talking about, that is the first step is something like a public service announcement. There's quite a few videos on YouTube actually of, you know, professional training facilities putting together videos on how to deal with active shooter situations and whatnot. But that's just the first step. You know, you should definitely, after viewing something like that, come to the realization that you should probably look towards self-defense training, firearms training, tactics training, because all of this, it's common sense, but if it's unfamiliar to you, it's not the first thing that's happening that you're doing, especially in an adrenaline-infused situation.
Right. I totally agree. Completely agree. Can get hairy, you know? I mean, combat mindset, you know? Combat mindset. Boy, we heard about that for a long time. And now it's ever increasing, like it's needed now. You know, everybody should wear that at all times now. I mean, we're not talking about, hey, you know, let's get paranoid. No, we're not. This is the world we live in, guys. This is exactly the world we live in, combat mindset. I mean, you know, using that mental code of awareness, right? So go ahead, David, because you want to say something a while ago.
No, I was just thinking, you know, that now that we're having all these attacks, not just in the U.S. and U.K., and they had an attack in Paris recently as well with a guy with a hammer.
Yeah.
And you know, now when I'm walking down the street, and I've kind of been this way for years, but now I have a 4.5-month-old son, and so I'm carrying my son either in the stroller or on a carrier on my chest, and I'm always thinking to myself, myself, well, what do I do if I have this kid strapped to my chest and someone comes and tries to attack me? How can I defend myself against and defend my child against that attack?
That's a new training right there, David Guy.
That's a new training, but it's something that as parents we got to start to think about and consider.
Exactly. I mean, you know, it's unfortunate, but then it just, you know, makes us more become resilient around us, more vigilant, I guess, you know. But, you know, it doesn't make any value, I should say, if we don't put this into training, if we don't put this into a reality, like, hey, you know what, let's wake up. This is real. This is happening. We cannot be the sheep. Like, you always say this before, right? We cannot be having this mentality, like, oh, it's never going to happen to us, you know, never going to happen to me. It does happen. You know, what if? We're not trying to create paranoia here, but you all know this. You all are just great seasoned instructors in well-rounded, I guess, you know, firearms. And what else do you do, Patrick? I mean, the self-defense. You mean you do also tactics and then the rape prevention as well, right?
Yeah, self-defense, rape prevention, or, you know, what I'm calling now is women's self-defense, because you're not really preventing a rape. That's usually a surprise, or it's, you know, in a situation where you've made yourself vulnerable, so.
Right. Yeah,
it's all important, you know.
Training is vital.
What we talked about earlier about how schools used to have, you know, firearms training teams. They used to have in sports competitions, and they taught firearms safeties in school. You know, we've gone away from that, and everybody is, the whole society has just kind of gotten away from that. And an example recently in Oakland, was it in Oakland? I don't know. It was on the BART, the Bay Area Rapid Transit System. A group of kids, you know, I don't know how, maybe teenage or just a little bit older, started robbing people on the train, a group of them. No weapons, but, you know, walked off with a lot of wallets and jewelry and whatnot, and nobody did anything about it. You know, if that had been in my grandfather's day, all of those kids would have gotten their heads stomped into the floors. You know, but everybody's just very, very passive, very pacified society today. And all of this is unfamiliar to us, where self-defense and fitness and firearms is just very unfamiliar to us.
Because it's been taken away.
When a situation arises where you have to call upon those types of traits, we don't have those anymore as a society.
I hate to say this, but it's in control, right? By whom? Well, we know the answer by whom in control, right? Society is more compelling interest in more control, correct? Is that? Can I say that?
Right. Yeah.
Right?
Also, I'd like to say that one thing that we've been doing, especially in America and the UK as a society and as a culture, is we've been making a big effort to suppress one simple, basic, natural fact of humans. Humans are a top-of-the-line alpha predator.
Oh, absolutely.
That's what we were designed to do. We were given the intellect, the forward-facing eyes, and the tools, meaning our hands, our teeth, our brain. to fight and take over other animals and kill.
Right.
And we've been suppressing that and trying to be something, you know, with a better moral calling, I guess, or moral standing, and we forget the fact that that's still in us. That primate side of us is still there. That animal instinct to hunt and kill and survive is still there. And some people can't suppress it, can't control it as well as other people. And some people use it to take advantage of other people. They don't want to suppress it or control it at all. So we've been suppressing that as a culture and as a society by, one, making it seem immoral or bad to fight or be aggressive, and we punish people a lot of times who defend themselves. Even the people who defend themselves now seem to get punished legally by the court systems. So people now, they have a fear of, oh, well, if I fight back, what's going to happen to me? Will I have to go to court? Will I go in jail? You know, this kind of stuff. It's not, a lot of people don't just worry about the physical pain of things.
But the financial side of it too.
Yeah, the legal side of it too, right? And even here in Thailand, if you get involved in a third party defense situation, a lot of Thai people won't get involved because they don't want to have to go to police and explain themselves and then possibly have to go to court.
And pay a lot of money.
So,
right.
It costs them time and money and everything else, and they're worried that they'll be civilly liable in a lawsuit. So, you know, we need to get, as humans, we need to get back on track with the ability to defend yourself, not just in the U.S. and the U.K., but worldwide.
Worldwide, yeah, I agree. I mean, it's just education, you know, they're educating this mentality.
Yeah.
It's so bad.
Well, I mean, in the U.K. now, it's to the point where, okay, they've pretty much outlawed guns. Legal ownership and use of guns or carrying of guns is highly restricted or illegal in most of the country.
Look at where most of the tragedy is right now. Just recently.
And then they went one step further and started banning carrying of knives.
Hmm.
And so now you can't even carry a pocket knife in public in the UK. If you carry a pocket knife, you're considered a criminal.
Hmm.
Which is just, to me, it's just ridiculous.
Right.
Ridiculous. And now in Thailand, we're starting to see the same kind of trend where they start to say, it's legal to own it, but it's not legal to carry it.
Hmm.
And or it's legal to carry it, but it's not legal to use it in a self-defense situation, which to me is ludicrous, ludicrous. And right now, when you're getting onto the SkyTrain system here in Bangkok, the elevated train system, the security is checking people. They're checking their bags at random, and they see me have a knife. I carry a pocket knife with me everywhere I go, usually just one, but sometimes more. And they ask me, oh, you cannot. And I have to tell them in Thai, yes, I can. I know the police. I know the law. I can legally carry it. And then they try to guilt me into giving it up.
Right.
They say, oh, well, why do you carry it? Who do you want to hurt? What are you scared of? Don't you see their security? And all this kind of stuff. But to me, it doesn't matter. None of that stuff matters because I'm not going to depend on you to defend me.
It's God's given right, right?
Right. God gave me the ability to
right.
defend myself.
God's given rights. You can't make me. Sorry.
Yeah. So there's been situations where I tell them, look, it's not illegal. I'm going to carry my knife. Have a nice day. Bye-bye. And I keep walking. And they can't do anything to me legally about it.
There's no fine then for carrying like not right here in the U.S. where we, you know, legalize and everything, yeah? Have to have permit,
yeah,
license?
There's no fine for carrying a knife. You have to have a permit to carry a gun, and if you're caught carrying a gun without a permit, you can get a fine or jail time depending on the situation and the circumstances.
It's like a federal thing, right?
And, of course, the connections that you have, political or, you know, or things like that, or who you can pay off.
Yeah, the bribe and everything like that. Well,
so,
you know, welcome to Thailand. Yeah, what do you think, Patrick?
I think these are all parts of the problem, and I'm a problem and solution kind of guy. You
yeah.
know, we could talk about this for
all day.
Hours,
yeah,
days,
the problems.
But nothing really gets accomplished unless there's some solutions, and some solutions that our governments are willing to take and individuals are willing to take, you know, steps, courses of action, just like training yourself.
Yeah.
You know, but at the same time, the reason why we have to look at the stem, the root of this, the root of this problem. Why are these attacks happening?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in most examples, not in all, in most examples, it's a basic conflict of ideologies, right? There's a certain way that a certain group of people think, and it's conflicting with a certain way that another certain group of people think, and because of that, violence ensues.
Hmm.
There has to be a way for both parties eventually to to come to the table and figure out how to coexist on this freaking planet without killing each other.
Right.
And it's ridiculous. It's barbaric, and we're a civilized world now, and some groups of people need to catch up, you know, and it's government's responsibility. It's our government. We pay our government to be responsible about these situations, and they're not. Why are there so many attacks happening in the UK right now? Because they took in a bunch of refugees. Some of those refugees even left the country to get more training so that they could come back and conduct these attacks. Some of them aren't even refugees. One of the biggest unconventional threats to any state's national security is homegrown terrorism.
Yeah.
You can't do anything about it. It's a surprise attack. You know, we have to come to the root of that problem. Why is there homegrown terrorism? Why is there ideological conflicts happening? What is this violence all about? You can do all the handgun training and self-defense training you want, but that is not going to make this go away. That's going to put a band-aid on things for you, but it's
right.
not going to end this.
No.
It's not going to end any of this. It's going to continue to happen. They're going to find ways. Even though guns and knives are banned, they're conducting attacks with guns and knives. That is not working.
It is not. Go ahead.
Sorry, rant over.
No, that's okay. That's okay. Because, I mean, we're in the same energy with that and with yours. It's just that, you know, why are they controlling that? You know, like controlling, hey, is a gun's fault? Is a knife's fault? I just don't get it. I just cannot wrap that around my head.
Some of the blame actually lies with the government, firstly, in the UK. I can say that straight out without a doubt.
Yeah, absolutely.
One, they encourage these people to come to their country knowing where they were coming from, knowing that they were that they had no way of checking their backgrounds, and knowing that they were of what we would call a combat age, right? Between 18 and 35 is a combat male age. And then they brought them in, put them into government-supported housing, financed them by giving them welfare checks. So they were state-sponsored homegrown terrorists, sponsored by UK.
You don't think it's going on around here too, as you're talking?
Oh, I know it is. It is.
Yeah.
It is. There are very well documented Islamic jihadist training camps in the U.S. that are all funded by welfare and social services.
Wow. Well, what do you think, Patrick?
I think this goes back to the social contract.
Mm-hmm.
Our government is failing in their part of that.
I totally agree.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we just lost him again. All right. Well, I'm going to get back on him. That was interesting. It's a very good point, by the way. It's an extremely good point, what Patrick just brought up. Social contract. And
you've reached my voicemail.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is happening also all over the world, you know. I mean, they're getting just so sophisticated.
Right. Well, okay, so let's look at the UK stabbers. The guy,
right.
the UK terrorist.
We have Patrick back again. Okay.
The UK attackers, they came into the UK on refugee status. Two out of three of them came into the UK on refugee status, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. And then they were all getting money provided to them by the government. They were in state-subsidized housing, state-subsidized food. They're all going and getting, what do you call it?
Pretty much taken care of by the government,
brainwashed by their local imam to go ahead and carry out terrorist acts. And the UK government knew that these guys were doing it and said that the reason that they allowed them in was so that they could watch them.
What?
That doesn't make any sense to me. Why? And they keep saying, oh, well, we allow these imams to keep preaching their hate and their jihadist extremism so we can monitor them. That doesn't make any sense.
Doesn't make
don't
any
monitor
sense.
Them. Kick
monitor
them the hell out
what?
Of the country.
Kick their ass. out. Excuse my language.
Yeah, just kick them out. Why do you need to keep them in your house so you can keep an eye on them? That's like inviting a burglar into your house just to see what he might try to steal.
Yeah, I mean, this is just doesn't make sense, you know? Guys, what do you think? I mean, it just doesn't make sense, some of the things that the government does.
Yeah,
it doesn't. It's all a part of that social contract, what I was going to say earlier before I... self-reception.
Yes, okay. We know.
The government, you know, we pay to have a government that's supposed to protect us from chaos and anarchy. And they are definitely not holding up their end of the contract, even though we are paying our taxes and paying their salaries to do so. This is the main thing that our taxes are supposed to go towards is our security.
Yeah.
Not... to study how fast a shrimp can run.
Yeah, exactly, on a treadmill.
You know,
right.
It's to provide security for us, and they're failing. And what David just brought up is something that I hear over and over again with the FBI. The FBI was monitoring this person, but they always say that after the attacks. The FBI was monitoring this person. Well, why didn't they act on it? You know, and usually that's the case, is because they want to find, you know, they're monitoring them so they can find the bigger nests. Well, we know where the bigger nests are. They're in Yemen, they're in Somalia, they're in Eritrea, they're in Canada, they're in the U.S. We know where they are. We're just monitoring them. Well, we don't pay. Our part of the social contract is not to pay for our government to monitor these things. It's to pay for our security, and they are failing in it.
So, yeah, I totally agree. I mean, this is just not. What do you think? What are your thoughts, David?
You know, I think a lot of people have been banging on Trump for his immigration policies and all of this kind of stuff, even though a lot of them are the same as Obama had behind the scenes and the previous presidents had behind the scenes. They didn't publicize it. But, you know, I don't agree with everything Trump does, but I do agree with the fact that he's making people go through background checks before they come into the country, and he's looking at ways to get people who are causing problems out of the country. That I very much agree with. And it should have been happening for a very long time.
Like 10 years ago, and like 10, 15 years ago, I think. We're just 10, 15 years behind, I think, in this kind of thing, immigration, I think. Maybe more.
It should have been happening 30 years ago. As soon as somebody comes in and they set up a religion of hate, and they start preaching, death to infidels or death to whoever, it's time to go. You've got to find somewhere else to live.
Right.
What's sad is half of our country would be appalled with what you just said about doing background checks to come into the country. For some reason, half of our nation is appalled by that, the fact that we want to do that. The same half, I might add, that's appalled by, politicians that want people to show their IDs before they vote, like that's some type of racial discrimination. No, it's not. You know, half of our country would, that's what's sad to me, is half of our country would be appalled at what you just said about...
The background check, you mean? Yeah.
Doing background checks before we let them in. Which just sounds so simple, so basic.
But wait a minute, guys.
Important.
Right, but wait a minute. When you go overseas, that's the first thing those other countries do to us, right?
Yes,
that's right.
That's the first thing. You go to other countries, I'm not going to say which one, but you know every other country in this planet would say, hey, you know what? You pay. You know, even tourists, you're going to have to pay more. But, you know, people are showing up in our country here and they get paid, right? I mean, I can't say this, right?
For example, I just applied for a visa to Vietnam. I'm going there on executive protection detail. And I had to submit my application 4 days prior to it takes them 4 days to process the application. So for me, that means I got to do it about a week and a half in advance of my flight. And it puts in all my information in there. And the reason that they're asking for 4 days is because they want to be able to run a background check on you.
Yeah.
And see exactly who you are coming into Vietnam.
Right. And then you're going to have to get tetanus, medical shots, and stuff like that, correct? The malaria.
Vietnam doesn't require that stuff, but a lot of other countries do.
Yeah,
what annoys me is when I go back to my own country, I'm an American citizen. They have, you know, now they have the RFID chips in your passport. They can scan your background in an instant.
Right.
At the airport.
I retina.
But because I've traveled the world working as a private security contractor in places like Iraq and Afghanistan and Egypt and Thailand and all these other countries, now when I go back, they take me off to the side as an American citizen and start to interrogate me, even though they've already got my full background. But the Palestinian guy, the Pakistani guy, the Arab guy right behind me, with a non-U.S. passport, he walks right through because he doesn't have an RFID chip in his passport.
Hmm. So let's talk about that a little bit, about, you know, how you know, traveling and then being... Well, what do you think, Patrick? Because I know you travel also across the Europe and everything else.
I think that we should be keeping to the international standards that everybody else does. It shouldn't be such a shock that we need to do background checks, you know, with people coming into this country, especially from countries that may be on a list of known terrorist training hotbeds. You know, I mean that's just common sense, and the fact
yeah,
that people,
it is common,
you know,
sense.
The fact that people think that's racial profiling or something is ridiculous, because, as David pointed out, it is done to us when we go into other countries, and it's not necessarily like we're picked out of a crowd. It's everybody's getting checked going into some of these countries. It's not racial profiling. It bugs the crap out of me when I see grandma or a six-year-old kid getting pat searched at the airport.
You know, like, right. Right, exactly. Like, what the hell?
Just because we're trying to be politically correct and not be accused of racial profiling, that's ridiculous.
Well, you know, I think we talk about the Manchester attack, the guy that nobody, you know, suited with all bombs and everything like that, nobody said anything about him. You know, I mean, past security. Remember that, David? We talked about it. It's like nobody really wanted. Hey, you know what? That looks kind of unusual. That doesn't look right. Nobody wants to talk. No, nobody wants to say something. Say something. If you see something unusual.
Pale, large jacket, heavy backpack.
Yeah, heavy backpack.
Standing in a strange location. Nobody says anything.
No one says anything about this guy. You know, what do you think?
And that brings us back full circle to what we started with situational
awareness. Exactly, situational awareness. Wear that in condition yellow. You know, you diagnose all of the situation in the around your vicinity, around your environment, and then it doesn't feel right, doesn't look right, you say something, right? So this is
that's to the point now where American citizens have less rights than immigrants coming into the U.S.
I think so, too. Yeah. Wow.
They definitely face tougher screenings, and it seems like it might not be racial profiling, but it's definitely national profiling, and it's not in the way that you would think. They're not profiling the countries that are known for terrorism as much as they are profiling their own people and wanting to know, you know, why did you go there? Why did you come there? They take me off to the side, and in one instance, tried to question me for almost 6 hours just because I was coming back from Iraq. And I
back
said, look, I went there working for the U.S. government. I was there as a private security contractor. Here's the photos on Facebook. Here's the videos on Facebook of what I was doing. Look at this and leave me alone. And tell me why you let the guy that was on the same flight from Iraq with me with an Iraqi passport walk right through with no question.
Wow. Just like that, huh?
Just like that.
Wow, that's interesting. We just lost Patrick again. All right. So, yeah, I mean, national profiling. Yeah, we go to other countries, and other countries don't, you know the rest. We just cover that.
Well, in Thailand, they do racial profiling. They do it. And they'll tell you they do it.
Mm-hmm.
And really, I can support it, and I can understand it, because in Thailand, they know the following things. Nigerians are always getting caught for drugs.
Right.
Pakistanis and people from other Muslim countries are often caught with weapons and explosives that they shouldn't be having.
Wow.
So for them, they know it Chinese people, they know that they're going to create some social issues and things like that. So they know, based on the experiences with these cultures, what's going to happen. And so they profile based on that. So racial profiling works to some extent.
Yeah.
I don't see why not. Why the U.S. doesn't do it.
Well, we have a lot of heart bleeding. I don't want to go into details about that, but, you know, heart bleeding. Like, half of the majority, right, Patrick? You were saying? Because we have half of that.
Yeah.
Millions of other people say, no, don't do that. We'd rather be just like, you know, getting killed or getting possibly getting injured. No thanks. We're trained for that. No thanks. You guys may, but go right ahead. Yeah. So, you know. All right, so we have a little bit more time, trying to wrap this all up then, I guess. I mean, some last thoughts, Patrick.
Well, my final thoughts, kind of bringing it back to the beginning, is just, you know, in order for us to be effective at doing something about this, the individual needs to take some initiative and, as we mentioned before, educate. And our government definitely needs to do a better job of, holding down their end of the social contract that we pay them to do, you know, because that is definitely not happening, even though every year we increase the budgets of those agencies and, law enforcement agencies. It's for some reason increasing their budgets, funneling more money to them isn't working, you know.
Yeah, it doesn't have any effect. What about you, David Gray?
The government definitely needs to step up.
Yeah, I hear you. I think I'm in agreement with you on that one. What about you, David?
I agree with Patrick some as well. And one of the ways that they can step up is that they can also hold other countries responsible for the actions of their citizens abroad. Also hold those countries responsible for some of the screening efforts that are involved with people who want to travel to other countries. We give so much financial aid, so much medical aid, so much food assistance to other countries. The least that they can do is give us a little bit of assistance with screening people that want to come to the U.S.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, with Trump in the office, I mean, he's been cutting some of the social assistance as well, right? I mean, we saw that in the recent, what do you call that? The climate thing? I know it's nothing to do with it, but, you know, he cut that too. So he said that, you know,
anyway,
I mean, it's
on a personal level, I think that each citizen has their own responsibilities that they need to worry about in their life, of course, their whole family and their daily life, but they also have a responsibility to learn to defend themselves and defend their loved ones. And this is something that we used to do in the U.S. before, and other countries still do it. Russia still teaches firearms in their school. They still teach self-defense in their school. China still teaches self-defense in their schools. The U.S., for some reason, has gotten away from it.
Yeah.
So this is something that needs to be taught, again, worldwide. This needs to be something that's added into the school curriculums, or it needs to be taken up on a personal level. You train yourselves. And I can't emphasize that enough.
I think the word control has something to do with it. What do you think? Don't you think, Patrick? The word control.
What?
Control.
Control?
Yeah, control. I think that's something to do with it. Why things are disappearing, you know? I think...
They teach safe sex in schools. Sex education and safe sex, but they don't teach self-defense. They don't teach first aid and first response type.
It's a life-saving education. It's a life-saving skills. If you apply that, life-saving skills, I mean, you can use that in so many different aspects of how you can save your life, basically. I think we need to talk about that. We need to open this up and say, hey, you know what, guys? We need to continue. We've been there before, back in the day. We need to open this up again. We need to continue discussing this because this is life-saving skills. I mean, the more that they know how to use safely, properly, the firearms, the more educated they are about that, about these tools, the better they are. They begin to respect what it is, right?
Not even just firearms. Okay, you have driver's ed training, right? So they teach you how to drive and park and use a turn signal and all of that kind of stuff and wear the safety belt and how the ABS works in your car and how
right.
the airbags work in your car.
Same applies.
Why not include the first aid training course in that? And why not require people to carry more than road flares and a spare tire? They should carry a first aid kit in their car.
Right. Right. Well said. Very well said. Education, training. I mean, it's very vital. We can say this all over again. Very vital. But, you know, it's too bad. But, you know, civilians, you're right. We do have responsibility as a civilian, as a person, on a personal level, too. I'm going to say this out loud. We have fiduciary, I mean, you know, responsibility. A teacher also, right, to teach students, take care of them. You know, we as parents, we as social entrepreneurs, we as business owners, we have a lot of responsibility. We're parents also. What do you think, Patrick?
Yeah. I mean, yes, that is the key is education. And yes, parents need to teach their kids. Those kids grow up and be parents need to teach their kids. That's exactly what we were talking about earlier, that this country is definitely getting away from, you know,
yeah.
education, knowledge, you know, in order to be good at anything or in order to understand anything like the situations we've been talking about, you have to be knowledgeable. Otherwise, you just stand there and freeze and you become a victim.
That's right.
So if you're not knowledgeable on something, you're going to be a victim.
Right. Well, this gentleman, you know, David Gray and Patrick Garrity, I mean, they're certainly the ones that you need to talk to, especially you guys, ladies. Okay, we run out of time as always. This is a great topic, you guys. So we need to continue discussing this and stay aware and stay alert in many, 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 many ways. If so, you happen to be in Southeast Asia, please do drop by. You're in Thailand, Bangkok, right? Visit him, David Gray. Check out his website. What is it again? You can let us know how to contact you.
Deimossecurity.com, DEIMOS-security.com.
And
you can find us on Facebook under Deimos Company Limited, DEIMOS-LTD.
And you have also several, I think, Facebook groups, pages, correct?
Yeah, we have three. We have one for Bangkok, one for Hong Kong, and one for Singapore.
Right. Very good. And, you know, he is a very highly seasoned instructor, you guys. I had the privilege to train with you, remember, decades ago when he was out here in the U.S. decades ago. So I'm really proud of you to travel a long way in your journey. And then you have your son now, cute little baby. Oh, my gosh. He looks just like you, by the way. How old is he, 4 months now?
4 and a half, yeah, he's growing fast.
Yeah, you got to have to start thinking about considering this teaching how to protect your baby when you're a parent, when you're a dad, you know.
Yeah.
That's going to be a great new training. Also, if so happen you are in Santa Barbara area, please visit Patrick Garrity for some training. These two gentlemen are only phone calls away, only Facebook pages away, and then your Facebook page also. How to contact you, Patrick?
Yes, Facebook page, Patrick Thomas Garrity. You can find me on DFT's website at www.dftraining.com. That's about it.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a pleasure being with David and Nikki again tonight. Thanks for having me back on, Nikki.
Oh, as always, it is a pleasure. I'm very humbled to have you both. The gentleman only phone calls away, like I said, guys. Remember, disaster does not recognize who or what you are, and it doesn't recognize your financial status or your title, your social status, and ethnicity, age, or gender. So acquire proper training, like both of you have been saying here, life-saving skills that may save your life and your loved ones. Invest in some of these life-saving trainings. And these two gentlemen can offer those great, valuable trainings, by the way. So thank you for listening. My favorite Marines, as always, thank you both for your service. Thank you so much, great friends, David Gray and Patrick Garrity. I'm very humbled to have you both join me discussing this very important topic, and hopefully you can come back next time. All right? We all need to stay alert of our surrounding at all times, you guys. Stay vigilant, watch your six. Until next time, I'm Nikki Dare, your host. God bless. Signing off.
You have been listening to Nikki Dare's Radio, a podcast of sustainability with your host, Ms. Nikki Dare. To learn more, please visit Ms. Dare's website, education.nikkidare.com. Workshops on safety preparedness, situational awareness are available. Also available, the Transformational Coaching Series. For corporate and private group pricing, please contact us. She also offers both private and group classes in firearms training, handgun, rifles, and shotgun for individuals and families, and home invasion scenarios. For details on Nikki Dare's outdoor hiking, yoga, and her other outdoor activities, and her passion for fitness and upcoming classes, please visit her website, NikkiDare.com. Join the community conversation to network and learn on different outdoor fun on her website, NikkiDare.com/freeforum. Follow her on LinkedIn and her social media, Twitter, Instagram, Google+, Pinterest, and Facebook. Or simply watch her tutorial videos. You can subscribe to her YouTube channel, Nikki Dare. All about her books and inspirational quotes can be found on her website, books.nikkidare.com. Check out her newest website, travel.nikkidare.com, for all travel resources, savings, and tips. Her calendars, both of living in purpose and passion, as well as her exclusive edition of Firearm Safety, are available for order on her website, NikkiDare.com. All of her broadcasts are available for free download on iTunes podcast, Nikki Dare. For more details on opportunities for sponsorships and speaking engagement, please email us at education@nikkidare.com. Join her next time, living in purpose and passion. Our mission is to live a sustainable life with your host, Nikki Dare.